Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the legislature in downtown Raleigh, it's Friday, March 3rd, 2017. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for clicking play. This week in state politics, well, it included Governor Roy Cooper's budget proposal, a bright red coat, more HB2 bluster, and a surprise visit to our press room here on Jones Street. Here to make some sense, hopefully, of it all is Gary Robertson, Associated Press reporter, the unofficial mayor, we should note, of the Capitol Press Corps. Gary, thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here, Jeff. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's begin with Cooper's budget proposal. What stood out to you?
What stood out was the, not necessarily that it was unexpected, but he has talked about education and public schools and, you know, really increasing that funding basically from the time he started running for the position, you know, 2-3 years ago, depending on who you ask. The fact that he has a budget that basically raised overall spending year over year by over 5%.
It's a big number.
It is a big number compared to previous additions and of budgets by Republican leaders, and this whole focus down on Jones Street of keeping spending in check. But he, you know, he did do some things that maybe Republicans will like. Clearly, teacher pay, and
right. It
aligns, while the details are unknown, the bottom line in terms of how high average pay would go seems to align with what Senate Leader Phil Berger wants. That seems to me that is something that will ultimately be in the budget. Just the details are unclear, but no tax increases.
No fee increases. Or
he says no fee increases.
Right.
A tax cut, if you look at child and dependent care tax credit that the governor wants restored, although the Republicans saw those kinds of those incentives or those tax credits as something that should be eliminated during the tax overhaul earlier this decade. And then he put over $300 million in the rainy day fund. It's sure something that the Republicans will like. And it's interesting given the fact that, as you remember, the rainy day fund and how high or low it should be was an issue in the campaign where there was some criticism suggesting that Governor Cooper, then candidate Cooper, didn't like the idea of a high rainy day fund. And he's kind of, maybe he's proven that wrong, at least in this plan.
Right, right. So I guess a couple of things to note, and you touched on this, kind of a 2.5 to 3% growth model in recent budgets with Republican leadership. This is more significant than that. Obviously, it's a higher figure. This is largely symbolic. The governor does not appropriate money, him or herself, but he represents the Democrats, and the Democrats haven't had a seat at the table in recent years with the supermajorities and with a governor, Pat McCrory, who is Republican. This is also the beginning of a long process. We won't have a final budget until late June or early July.
I'd be thrilled if it was early July. Frankly, all of us would be.
We would be, yes.
It's the first step, and a governor's budget, when the governor is of the party opposite the controlling party in the legislature, carries less weight and heft, but it does set a tone of what the priorities of this Democratic governor is. And as I kind of think back to what Governor Cooper would like to accomplish, I think it's probably a good template might be when Governor Jim Martin was the Republican governor from 1985 to 1993, dealing, had no veto. Which is essentially what Governor Cooper has if Republicans are united. And Governor Martin was going against Democrats. And he offered a lot of ideas. And I think part of it is maybe not lowering expectations, but acknowledging that the programs that as a governor you want to present and pass may not have the same name on it at the end. It may not be the same numbers. But if you get people from the other party and in the legislature talking about these things, in many ways, that's a success. And so if he can continue to keep the discussion and the topics about education spending and about taxes, then perhaps it will, you know, perhaps he can consider it a success at the end of this session, no matter what the, you know, based on what the final budget is.
Right.
Again, he will, if he wants to, he'll be able to sign or veto it if he chooses. But again, we all know that if united, the Republicans can basically do what they want.
Right. This is a long, drawn-out process, as I mentioned. I said it again. Is there anything else before we move on to other topics that is worth noting as it pertains to the budget at this point?
It was interesting that he proposed issuing some debt, about $350 million mm-hmm. worth, that would not be subject to voter approval, mainly for building renovations and some construction. But it's interesting how that has occurred, given that just last year the voters they approved $2 billion in bonds in a referendum. The governor says he didn't feel like that this type of construction needed voter approval. And, you know, talked about what most chief executives talk about when they want to borrow: low interest rates and low construction costs right now make it a good time to borrow.
One of the other interesting stories that came out of this building this week was the appearance of Larry Hall, the former Democratic House rep from Durham. This after a back and forth of whether or not the Senate has the advice and consent ability to require confirmation. This hasn't been settled yet, we should note. But last week, the Senate issued a subpoena. Larry Hall was compelled. He showed up, and he did so in a bright red, a blood red Marine sport coat. He was holding a cigar afterward. I thought the theater of this was pretty good. What did you take away from
that? Well, we were joking that maybe he's in line with the red coat. Maybe he wants to be the next basketball coach at NC State. It looked like something, for your old listeners, like something Norm Sloan would wear back in the day. It was good theater. It's been good theater for the last few weeks, where they had an empty table for him, and he showed up. It did not show up, and now he did, because a three-judge panel decided not to step in and take a position on the governor's request to quash or delay the subpoena. My colleague Emery D'Alessio was in there, and I know that you were, and it seemed like to me that the questions were credible questions. They weren't political hand grenades, and that for all the conflict in the courts, it seemed to be a pretty straightforward process to have. Yeah. And also, you mentioned the theater having members of veterans in behind him, giving him support, really added for a nice picture for the public to see through TV and photos.
Yeah, yeah. About two dozen, I think there were about two dozen military members who were seated behind Hall yesterday during the 90 minutes or so. And to his credit, or just I guess to the notion that it was theater, when he came in yesterday, he shook pretty much every hand in the room. I mean, he worked the room.
Maybe he's running for something else.
Maybe he is running for something else. Do you anticipate that all of the confirmation hearings will go as smoothly, perhaps, as Mr. Hall's did yesterday?
I think many of us in the press corps, when we discuss this, think that many of them will, many of the eight, I guess there's eight that he has chosen so far out of 10.
Yeah.
There's two that still haven't been named. Most of them will probably go like that. There's a couple that have close connections to the legislature, and that should help. If I had to choose a couple that may not be as smooth, it may be the governor's choice to run environmental quality and also his choice to run HHS, because of the controversial nature of some of the things that they have to do. And it's been kind of a flashpoint for partisan fights,
right,
with Health and Human Services over Medicaid and with Department of Environmental Quality over some of the Obama administration mandates.
Right. So we also heard a lot this week on House Bill 186, which
That's
is
right.
the effort to significantly change House Bill 2. I think we had three different press conferences on Tuesday.
Yes.
The update here should be brief, right? Because there really is no update on House Bill 186 in terms of progress.
Based on what we see, based on who we've talked to in this building, it seems as though the impasse remains and that the primary sticking point appears to be over the allowing local governments, cities, to pass expand non-discrimination ordinances and then the ability of local citizens to force a referendum.
Right.
And that detail is apparently a non-starter for Governor Cooper and for legislative Democrats. The Republicans, while some say that that's negotiable, there's also seems to be some comments from House Speaker Tim Moore that is something that his members can't walk away from. They need to have some ability for local residents to combat what they may consider overreach by city councils. And so it seems as though I think there'll still be discussions continuing, but it just seems right now that there is no solution. There's no, because you can't have a partial referendum, or you can't find any sort of compromise that seems to satisfy either side.
Right. And there's still, from my perspective, a big groundswell, a large voice of people who are calling and want to see a full repeal. But at this point, there just isn't, as we've, I think, probably both mentioned in our reporting before, there isn't an appetite for it, enough of an appetite within the Republican caucus for a full repeal. There's the middle ground is, I guess you could look at it two ways. It's either there's a lot of ground in between them or there isn't any ground in between them at this point.
And also to point out that there are social conservatives in both chambers who are quite comfortable with HB2 because they I think there are a lot of rural lawmakers who believe or have seen information showing that it polls really well.
Yeah.
In their areas, a lot of conservative Christians and others who just don't, who have concerns about the types of ordinances that Charlotte passed that led to HB2 last March.
Right, right.
A year ago now, my goodness.
Right, just about a year ago, more than 11 months. And this, of course, speaks to the rural-urban divide that we have we've
definitely
all spent time focusing on and reporting on. To that point, one of those rural representatives, Senator Phil Berger, the leader of the legislature. I mean, he's the most powerful guy in the state, right? When we're talking about politics, he stopped by the press room this week. It was an impromptu visit, and as we're talking about the separation of powers between the executive and the legislative branches, and the lawsuits that are playing out, he came by unannounced to give us an update on one of these lawsuits. This is a rare visit, right? Like, this is not something that happens normally, and it caught us off guard.
I would say that it happens probably once or twice a year, if that, where the top legislative leaders come by to let people know about a certain topic or want to spin something a certain way. And I'm not saying there was necessarily spin by what Senator Berger told the press corps about Thursday, but he came in to talk about these separation of powers cases and was holding a court of appeals ruling that he said seemed to indicate that there was no board of elections or state ethics commissions right now to perform their duties. There are representatives of both the board and the commission who seem to indicate that that's not what the Court of Appeals ruling says. But it was interesting that he would come to further kind of explain that the courts or the litigation that is transpiring is leading to more uncertainty in how state government is run. And, you know, it speaks to just the continuing battle between the executive and legislative branches. Even the governor's office chimed in and said they didn't believe that that ruling basically left things as they were and not necessarily turned things upside down into chaos.
Right. And definitely confusion with a lot of this.
Confusion, yes.
On a similar note, last week, going back to the Hall thing for a moment, when the state Senate was about to issue that subpoena to Larry Hall, Senator Berger held a more formal scheduled press conference and said, pertaining to a different court ruling, I'll concede, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, I'll concede there are various ways to read this ruling, but we think we're in the right, which just points to some of these court rulings and the confusion and multiple sides, you know, potentially reading it differently and reading it in part correctly.
Well, the last couple of weeks over that one ruling that Senator Berger discussed, it was that you could, both sides, both Governor Cooper's office and legislative leaders, could take pieces from that ruling to bolster their arguments whether or not they could, whether the legislature could continue the confirmation process or not. And I guess we'll know coming up next week,
right? Yeah.
On the 7th, there will be more court arguments over not only the confirmation case, but other laws that appear that stripped Governor Cooper of his powers back in December. Your listeners probably remember the December special session.
Right.
So that'll maybe there'll be some more clarity after that ruling.
Sure.
After that hearing.
Right. Gary Robertson is your guest on the WUNC Politics podcast. We've been talking about the past few days here at the legislature in downtown Raleigh. Going to shift gears a little bit. I'm throwing you on the spot now, Gary, admittedly, with a trivia question I asked on the podcast last week that nobody correctly answered.
All right.
And that question is, who was the last vice president of the United States to have no previous experience as a federal official before becoming the nation's number two? And you can stew on that one if you like. It's a good thing this isn't live.
My first answer would be Spiro Agnew.
Wow, that is the correct
answer.
Wow, well done.
He was a former governor of Maryland when he became, I guess he was governor. Excuse me, President Nixon's 68 running mate. If
yes.
That's right.
Yes.
So, you don't want play.
Well done.
If I'm playing Trivial Pursuit, you better watch out because my wife won't play Trivial Pursuit with me. Because of that, so
because she gets frustrated because you win.
Probably so.
Nice.
I'm probably competitive too.
I can attest to that. I imagine you're a competitive Trivial Pursuit player.
I am.
You're also a former paperboy for the Washington Post. You grew up in Southern Maryland.
In Northern Virginia.
Northern Virginia.
In Alexandria, and during high school and part of college, I would slog the heavy Washington Post editions around the neighborhoods, and really, I'm not saying that made me made me want to be a journalist, but it was neat to be a part of that, delivering news. There was a level of excitement every morning at 5 a.m. when the papers were dropped off, and you'd cut the plastic wrap and find out what happens. So we were talking off air, also some big events. This will show you how old I am, but delivering papers about Ronald Reagan's landslide, about the Challenger disaster in early 1986, some of the events related to the end of the Cold War. It was fun, and it really helped me want to. I enjoyed that kind of. It really wasn't a high at 5 in the morning, but it was exciting to share that with the rest of the world, obviously during an era where we had no computers or cell phones or we had the brick cell phones.
Right, right. Did you drive? Did you bike? Did you walk the paper route?
I did a little bit of both. I walked and I biked, and on Sundays, incredibly, my father would drive me around, and I was on our station wagon, and I would jump out because those were big papers.
Right.
The Sunday Washington Post, again, I think it was still it was probably a dollar back then, but even during the week, it was 25 cents, I think, until the early 2000s. But you got a lot for your money with the Washington Post, and maybe my back problems today are a result of it.
Again, putting you on the spot, do you have favorite all-time Washington Post writers or columnists or sections, or like when you think of the Washington Post, are there people or stories that stand out?
Well, as you know, Jeff, I'm a big sports fan. I love Washington and Baltimore sports, and Tom Boswell, the Washington Post columnist, is one of my favorites. So was the late Shirley Povich, and who was is Maury Povich's father, who he passed away. So that was great. Obviously, the comics in the Washington Post were always legendary. Three or four pages worth. I like the Outlook section, still like it today, always, you know, having differing voices. But as I told you also, I got to, in high school, call in the results of the high school football and basketball games, and that was always a treat to see it in the next morning's paper, even though it was about 40 words. It was still cool to be a part of a great American institution.
Do you still get any papers delivered to your home?
I do get the News and Observer, yes. Okay. Yes.
And can you get the Washington Post down here? Would they do a Sunday delivery? Do you know?
I think there are some ways to do it, but
not to guilt trip you for not doing it.
I think I helped the Washington Post quite a bit for many years.
Yes. After you delivered papers, and we're not going to go through your entire life history here, but I do want to touch on William & Mary because you're a William & Mary grad, the Tribe doing okay this basketball season.
They've had better years. William & Mary is one of a handful of teams, and I'm sorry I don't have the actual details on this.
But it's less than 10,
yes,
isn't it?
Of the original NCAA teams in Division I basketball, they are one of a handful that have never made the NCAA men's basketball tournament. We're hopeful this year. I think they're the number 4 seed in their conference tournament, but they have to face UNC Wilmington, which has an incredible team. And, you know, first round, if they make it to the tournament, watch out whoever has to play
right.
them.
Yeah.
I'm a Tribe person but always like the obviously the Triangle area college teams. I have one child who's at UNC right now, so always rooting on the Tar Heels.
To close the loop on the Seahawks, they were in the tournament last year. They lost in the first round to Duke, I believe.
I think
right?
It was a close game, was it not?
I believe it was a close game. And the head coach of the Seahawks, Kevin Keats, could be the next coach of the Wolfpack. So some interesting.
Maybe he should call Larry Hall and get that
get that blood
minus
red suit.
Minus the Marine Corps label.
Right.
Patch.
All right, we'll close on Carolina Duke. Will your daughter be at the game tomorrow? And will you be rooting for the Tar Heels?
Oh, I'll be rooting for the Tar Heels.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like I know this is. Terrible things. I mean, it's not like I don't like Duke, but I do want Carolina to succeed, and I don't believe she'll be at that game, but I know that she'll be watching with a lot of her friends.
Good deal. Gary, thanks for coming on the podcast. Enjoyed it.
It was a lot of fun.
That's all for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. Share the episode on Twitter or Facebook. Subscribe to the program on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And of course, you can find all the latest political stories at our website, WUNC.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend.